Hey everyone, welcome to the Faith Chapel podcast. We are so glad to have you join us. Faith Chapel exists to help people follow Jesus, be transformed by Jesus, and be on mission with Jesus. No matter where you are on your spiritual journey, you're welcome here. If you have any questions about who we are or what you hear, you can visit faithchapel.cc or email podcast@faithchapel.cc. We'd love to hear from you. All right, let's dive into this week's message. Well, hello, everybody. So good to see you. Everybody who's online, thanks for joining us. And you are very important, but I need to acknowledge the people who are actually in the room because you made it to church and it's like below zero. So if you're not from Montana, we had the most mild winter. And I kept thinking, when it comes, it's just going to punch us in the face. And it did. It did. It's been crazy out there. So thanks for being here. Everybody, we're glad you're here. So we're in part five in a series that we're doing out of the book of 1 Corinthians. So 1 Corinthians is written somewhere between 50 and 52 AD by a man named Paul, who was formerly known as Saul. Saul was vehemently opposed to the message of Jesus, was trying to destroy the early communities of Jesus' followers, has a face-to-face encounter with Jesus in Acts chapter 9. Literally, like we use the term 180 degrees, but he's trying to destroy the church. He turns 100% around and he says, I'm going to try to create and build the church. So he then goes on multiple journeys around the known world, stopping at every large Greco-Roman city and planting a church to the best of his ability. One of the cities he came to was the city of Corinth. We'll talk more about that in future weeks. But in the city of Corinth, he spends a year and a half. And in that year and a half, a new church is established. It is the first non-Jewish church. It is started with non-Jewish, known as Gentile people. So it has some unique attributes. One being this, they were good Greek people. They were raised with a Greek worldview. They had certain ways of envisioning the world. They had certain ways of envisioning human relationships. And now they're trying to follow Jesus, but a whole bunch of their culture is coming with them. And they're trying to figure out, like, how do I actually move forward? So one of the things I love about this book is if you are trying to figure out who Jesus is, we call it being spiritually unresolved, you're going to just see a really raw perspective on the church. Paul is going to deal with some of the deep dysfunction in the church, okay? So a lot of times we think that churches should hide their dysfunction. Around here, we celebrate it. I am a hypocrite in recovery. You are a hypocrite in recovery. But what Jesus wants to do is heal it and make it better. So this is what he's doing. Here's the challenge that he's going to address. He hit on this in chapter one. Now we're in chapter three. By the way, we're going to make it through the whole chapter. We're speeding up, okay? It's the challenge of rivalry, friction, and an inability to get along. Chapter one, he brought it up. He said, I heard from someone in Chloe's household that in your church, there's just ongoing battles. There's jealousy. There's envy. You guys are fractioning yourselves off into pieces. And like, there's a lack of harmony. And here's why that's disturbing. In John, book of John, one of Jesus's last messages, he looks at his followers and he says this. The one thing that is going to make you different than culture at large is this. It is the way that you love one another. So Jesus looked at his disciples and said, human rivalry has always existed. People fragment down racial lines, down political lines, ideological lines. But he says, here's the thing that is going to be different. The hallmark of a follower of Jesus is this, is that they love one another. It's interesting. He didn't even say that the way they'll love people outside of the church. He said, it is essential that human beings in the church, followers of Jesus, love one another. And the people in Corinth are having a problem with that. And we're still having a little bit of a problem with that in the year 2021. So this is going to address some of the questions that we have about denominations. There's probably not a month or a couple week period that doesn't go by. People are like, so what's the deal with all the denominations? You know, why is there like, that church is the Church of Christ? I thought we were all Church of Christ. Huh? That church is the second church of, you can tell that they split off from a previous church. Like what's going on there? It's the same issue. It's the same issue. And Paul has this brilliant solution for it. He doesn't just say, hey, be nice to each other. He says, there's something wrong up here. The way you're thinking is leading to your conflict. Let's read together 1 Corinthians chapter 3. We'll read the whole text and then we'll come back and we've got six things that Paul says to help us learn to love well. Brothers and sisters, I could not address you as people who live by the Spirit, but as people who are still worldly, mere infants in Christ. So here's their pastor saying, you're a bunch of babies. Why are you being such babies? I gave you milk, the easiest thing to eat, the easiest thing to spiritually digest, not solid food, for you were not ready yet ready for it. Indeed, you are still. Now, a few years later, you're still not ready. You are still worldly. Okay. Now, what is he going to define as worldly? Notice this. For since there is jealousy and quarreling among you within the group of people who follow Jesus, are you not worldly? Isn't that the very definition of worldly? Are you not acting like mere humans? And he wants them to be more than mere humans. Quarreling is natural for humans. He says, I want you to be spiritually alive humans, resurrected by Jesus humans. For when one says, I follow Paul, and another, I follow Apollos, who's now a new teacher in Corinth. Are you not mere human beings? What, after all, is Apollos? And what is Paul? Who am I? They're only servants. Only servants through whom you came to believe as the Lord has assigned to each his task. Paul's now going to go through three metaphors to help them understand what the church should actually be. He's going to say they're a field. He's going to say they're like a building that's in the process of being built. And thirdly, he's going to say you're like a temple. I planted the seed. Apollos watered it. But God has been making it grow. So neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything. And this whole equation of how your church came to be, I'm not anything, but only God who makes things grow. The one who plants and the one who waters have one purpose, and they will each be rewarded according to their own labor. For we are co-workers, Apollos, Cephas, Peter, myself, we're co-workers in God's service. You are God's field, God's building. Here's the second metaphor. By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as a wise builder, and someone else is building on it. But each one should build with care. For no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. If anyone builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, their work will be shown for what it is. Because the day, notice how this has a capital D. This is referring to this, you'll find it throughout the Old Testament, particularly in the book of Isaiah, the day of the Lord. Okay, this teaching that one day God is going to come back to planet Earth. And it'll be the day of the Lord. Not a day, but the day of the Lord. And it's when he will deal with injustice, he'll deal with evil, he'll deal with everything that's wrong once and for all to recreate this world. The day will bring it to light. It will be revealed with fire. And the fire will test the quality of each person's work. If what has been built survives, the builder will receive a reward. If it is burned up, the builder will suffer loss, but yet will be saved, even though only as one escaping through the flames. Could we pause there for a moment? I get asked fairly frequently, hey, what's the deal with purgatory? Anybody heard of that term, purgatory? So it's not something that we teach around here, and to the best of my abilities, I read the Bible, I can't see purgatory. But if you come from a Roman Catholic tradition, you were raised with this teaching of purgatory. And purgatory is this, is that when you died, you weren't quite ready for heaven. So you went to purgatory, which is an uncomfortable place where you were refined and you paid for your sins. And once your sins were paid for, then you're allowed entrance into heaven. So where did this come from? If you follow Roman Catholic theology back far enough, this is where it came from. It came from this. You get in the fire, get a little toasty, but you're not destroyed. Eventually you get out. Next, Don't you know that you, yourselves, are God's temple and that God's Spirit dwells in your midst? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy that person. Very stern warning. For God's temple is, look at this word, it's sacred, meaning like holy, set apart, unique, special. God's temple is sacred, and you together, please notice that word, you together are that temple. Do not deceive yourselves. If any of you think you are wise by the standards of this age, you should become fools so that you may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness in God's sight. As is written, he's going to quote from the Old Testament twice. He catches the wise in their craftiness. And again, the Lord knows that the thoughts of the wise are futile. So then, no more boasting about human leaders. All things are yours. God's generous. He's giving you everything. Whether, and notice, all things are yours. He's going to include himself. Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas, Peter, he says your spiritual leaders are yours. You don't belong to them. They belong to you. Or the world or life or death or the present or the future. All are yours. And you are of Christ. And Christ is of God. First thing that Paul does is he asks this question. What is the sign of spiritual immaturity? What's the real sign of spiritually immature? Like, what does that look like? And we might say, well, it's somebody who's just brand new. It's somebody who's not familiar with the Bible. It's someone who just hasn't prayed much in their life, hasn't done their devotions, all those things. And we would tend to say that's spiritual immaturity. Here's what Paul says. I'm going to define what spiritual immaturity is. And it has nothing to do with how long you have been following Jesus. You can have arrested development as a disciple of Jesus. It has nothing to do with how passionate you are about your beliefs. He says, here's spiritual immaturity. The inability to love other people who bother you, who are different than you. Immaturity is this. I haven't been able to feed you real solid food, Paul says, because of this. Because your church is fragmented. Your church is filled with people who can't get along, who have envy and jealousy and pride, and my way is better. You need to think the way I think. He said that is the sign of spiritual immaturity. And that just causes me to pause for a second and to say, God, I hope I'm spiritually mature. And the way I can figure out whether or not I'm spiritually mature is to look at my relationships. If you, please, like I say this lovingly, but I really want you to think about this. If you find yourself constantly in conflict with other people, just constantly, what we tend to think is, look, I just have all these crazy people in my life. I want you to stop for a moment and think, what if I'm the common denominator? What if I'm the one, and like, it's me who has an inability to be grace-filled, to be forgiving, to be loving? Because if you are in conflict, Paul says you're immature and you cannot grow. I want to show you something for just a second. And before I show you these two pictures, okay, they're two logos, I give you permission to react to these two pictures emotionally. Okay, verbally, you have permission. Are you ready? Here's the first one. Super subdued, except for one person over there. It's like, surprising. Next one. Woo. Okay, a little bit better. I'm still kind of surprised. So one of the things, when I moved to Montana 9 years ago, I was not ready for this whole like grizz cat thing. It just was like a shock to me where I would meet people for the first time. I just moved here and they'd be like, so are you a grizz or a cat? And I'm like, like I'm a human, right? What does this mean? And like the way these people can be polarized, they just like move farther and farther apart. And so I have 3 boys that play football. 2 of them have already graduated and both of them were just really, the older two have been really great. My third son's gonna be great, but they all had offers to play college football. And, you know, there's like all these threads where you can find out who's being offered a scholarship. And so people, especially men, I just gotta say, it's mainly men, would catch me in the atrium. And when they came up to me, like, they're so serious. And I'm like, oh, this is gonna be a heavy conversation. And they look at me and they say, so who's your son gonna sign with? And I'm like scanning their body to see, do you have a cat or a... And if I don't know, I'm like, I'm not sure. That's it. That's his decision. He'll have to figure that out by himself. You know, like that type of thing. My second son, he just had to retire medically from football. He blew out his second knee in less than a year and a half. But he's playing for the Grizz. And last year, when they had the rivalry game, okay, Cat Grizz, like, we use terms like civil war. That's a horrible way to describe a sporting event, right? Anyway, they come together and he isn't playing because he's a redshirt freshman, but he wears his jersey and they sit together. And he called me after the game. He's like, Dad, we went to Bozeman. Like, I was walking by this grandma. She looked so sweet and kind. And she saw my jersey and she started cussing me out. She started screaming at me about you blankety blank Grizz. He's like, it was like really traumatizing for him. He thought he was going to get a hug from a grandma and he got cussed out for having the wrong jersey on. So this is human nature. We're tribal. We get involved in rivalries. Politically tribal. Theologically tribal. Paul says, in your church, you can't have team Apollos and team Paul and team Cephas. Now, nobody walks around today saying, hey, I'm on team Apollos. I gotta tell you, there are people who walk around and say, I'm on team John Calvin. I'm on team Martin Luther. I'm on team this, on team that. He says, listen, you've got to redefine what it means to be spiritually immature. Here's the second point. Paul's going to give these three images, and I'm going to walk through them quickly because we'll hit on them in a few minutes. He says, if you want to understand the church, there's all kinds of metaphors for the church, but Paul uses these three, like, purposely. They're just simple. They're organic. They're something that everybody could relate to. He says, here's your first. If you want to understand the church, here's the first thing. You need to think of it like a field. You need to think when you stand in the midst of a bunch of people who are saying, I want to follow Jesus, you're like a field. And it's a field that God wants to develop and see grow and become fruitful and mature. So when I came to Corinth, I showed up and like, I was the first person with this new Jesus movement. So I came and I spent a year and a half just planting seeds, just getting the soil ready. I was just planting the teachings of Jesus. And then after a year and a half, I had to move on. And along came a leader named Apollos. And Apollos came and he just poured water on the seeds that I had planted. And then along came some of the teachings of Peter, and it goes on and on. He goes, but here's what you have to understand. I could never make anyone grow. Apollos did not make any of you grow. You do not owe your salvation. You do not owe your personal resurrection to your spiritual leaders. He says, who are we? We're just simple help. It is God. It is God's church. It is God's field. It is not Paul's field. It is not Apollos' field. It is God who has brought about this Jesus movement in the city of Corinth. He's the one that springs things to life. He's the one that's trying to create fruit-bearing people who can feed a thirsty, hungry, desperate world. Don't look to me, Paul says. That's like the one that helped you like find Jesus. I was just doing my work. We're all on the same team. Then he uses the next illustration. He says, it's like a building. You gotta think of your church like a building. He says, when I came, I spent a year and a half just putting down a foundation. And he is so emphatic. The foundation has to be Jesus Christ. You cannot build a church on a political foundation. You can't build a church on a personality. You can't build a church on any of those. He says, I built a foundation of Jesus. Now other people in your midst are coming along and they're building on it. And that's okay. We're working together. You know, there's this beautiful term that Paul uses when he talks about the church being built. It's a Greek word. I'm going to say the Greek word and I bet you'll know what the English translation is. Architekton. Architekton. Architect. He calls Jesus the architekton, the master builder. He says, I laid a foundation, but your architekton is still there. And now you're building, you're becoming something more mature over a period of time. Then his next metaphor is a temple. And this we'll talk about at the very end because it is a radical concept. But he says, you're like a temple, a bunch of imperfect people who are being built step by step to represent God. So, number three, here's some lessons, okay? Here's some powerful things. You have to know this. There is only one team. There is only one team, Paul says, and it is Team Jesus. There is not a team Apollos and a team Paul. There is one team, and we're on the same team. And so why would you come together and be fighting against each other? Okay, later today, the Super Bowl is going to be played. What if Tom Brady, like, threw a fit, which he might, I'm not a big Tom Brady fan, and he like started punching his offensive linemen, like just kicking them in the rear. When they're, you know, he gets in behind, he's just like, you guys, what are the chances of the Buccaneers winning that day? They're not gonna win. His offensive linemen are gonna be like, fine, man, let this massive guy go tackle you. See if you don't need me. A team cannot fight against itself. So you're one team. Now, I know if you drive through whatever city you live in, you're like, well, okay, there's that church and this church and that church and this church that came out of that church. What's that all about? It's the same thing. We haven't always been able to get along. But man, Jesus is just saying, if you're going to thrive in Corinth, you're going to have to be able to decide, hey, we're on the same team. We can work together. There are essential things that we'll never compromise on, but there are a thousand things, the nuances of theology, that we're not going to fight about. There's only one team. Point number four is this, is that Paul says it's important that you build the right way. You build the right way. So as he goes back to that illustration of a foundation, he says, there's only one foundation. It's the foundation of Jesus. It reminds me a lot of the words that Jesus speaks from Matthew chapter 7, where he's talking individually about people building their lives, and he tells a story, a parable. He says, one guy built on a rock, and one guy built on the sand. And both of those houses are fine until the storm comes. And when the storm comes, the house that's built on the rock will survive. The one that's on the sand is going to be washed away. Now, what Paul's saying here is, listen, you are now building your church. And I find it fascinating that he puts the responsibility of the church being built not on the spiritual leaders, but on the people in the church. So he doesn't write to Apollos and say, this is how you build the church. He says, you are building this church together corporately. And he says, there's two types of building materials that you can use to build the church in Corinth. The first type is perishable. The second is imperishable. What is perishable building material? He says, wood, hay, and straw. Okay, wood, hay, and straw, they're easy things to find, and they are cheap. They're just cheap commodities, right? Like, oh yeah, this straw didn't cost anything. And you can build quickly and rapidly with wood, hay, and straw. Or he says, you could choose to build a church on imperishable things. Precious stones, gold, and silver. He said, either way, you'll build a church. But one day, the big D day, you're going to see what you built with. If your church was built with wood, hay, and straw, it was built on personality, it was built on ego, it was built on personal agendas, it was built on all these things, when the fire comes, you're going to come back and look at that church and you're gonna like, there's just nothing left. I was perishable. But if you build the church on gold, silver, and precious stones, you build it on the person of Jesus, you build it on grace and truth and forgiveness and hope, when a fire comes, what happens to precious stones, gold and silver, when they go through heat? They come out better, purified. Even something like COVID right now. And I'm working with pastors all over the country who are facing, like, we have as many freedoms here in Montana as any place I know of. I still have friends, their church has not met for 11 months. And they're like wondering what in the world is happening. And I tell them this, I'm saying, if your church was built, if the people built the church on the imperishable good things of God, it'll survive and it'll thrive and it'll be purified. But if it's built upon personal ego and alliance with a leader is built on envy and jealousy, there's not gonna be anything left. Build the right things. Build with the right things. This is about the church here, but I think it's also so personal for all of us. If you're like married, you can build a marriage and it'll look fine from the outside. It's built on everything that's cheap and convenient. But you know when your first big fire comes? You'll know. Did we build this thing on Jesus? You're trying to build a family, or if you're young, you're trying to build a career. It's easy to try to build it on the cheapest things. These things are readily available. We'll just put them together real quick. Nobody will be able to tell. They won't until the storm comes. Just take the time. Build on Jesus. Build on forgiveness. Build on truth. Build on grace. Build with the right things. Number five, this is really getting to the heart of the passage. This is like where Paul's going to address their overall mentality. He says, know whom you belong to. Know whom you belong to. This is how you're going to end the dysfunction in the midst of your church, the relational problems, is you think that you belong to me. Or you think that you belong to Apollos or to Cephas, Peter. Here's what this looks like in the Greek. In the Greek, we translate it, I follow Paul. Literally in the Greek language, it means I belong to. I belong to Paul. I belong to Apollos. I belong to Peter. And what Paul is getting through to them is this. If you think that you belong to your spiritual leaders, you have just reversed the very essence of the New Testament church. You're thinking about it entirely wrong. He goes on to say, don't you realize that all things have been given to you, including Paul, including Apollos, including Peter. They're a gift to you. Here's the challenge that churches have faced since 50 AD, is we think that the church exists to help a spiritual leader achieve their calling and agenda. Paul says, that's just a totally wrong way of thinking about it. Apollos exists, Peter exists, Paul exists, every spiritual leader should exist to help you achieve your spiritual calling. If this church is your home, you are not here for me. I am here for you. You are God's field. The pastor is not God's field. And if you belong to your spiritual leaders, you've just lost the very strength of the church. All spiritual leaders should be here to say, hey, I'm just here to help them be the hands and feet. It's the priesthood of all believers. It's the thing that the church can so easily lose is we think there's a couple of professionals out there who do the work of God. The only time the church is fully functioning the way that God intends it to function is when everybody in the room goes, hey, I am God's hands and feet and mouthpiece to this world. I represent him. And a good pastor, a good leader, Paul says, you don't owe them anything. They owe you service. They owe you teaching and encouragement and seeds and water so that you can flourish. The goal of the church is not to elevate the leader. The goal of the church is to elevate the people. And the leaders are just there to breathe life into it. I am adamant about this with our staff. If you can't tell, I'm getting a little like, our staff, I tell them over and over, the book of Ephesians is super clear. It says that the office, the job of the pastor
is to prepare God's people for acts of service. We're there to equip. So I have a personal conviction about this, because I think we so easily turn Christianity into a spectator sport. I don't think in my life I've ever introduced myself as pastor. I've never met anybody and go, hey, I'm Pastor Nate. Here's why. When you read the New Testament, the word pastor is always a verb. It is never a noun. Pastor is something you do. It's not a title. And if I can keep that in, right in my mind, I can understand that my job is to serve you and watch God do something miraculous. You're part of his field. Watch him develop and resurrect and create life. We're just on a team together. Here's the sixth and final point. A new way of envisioning what we'll call sacred space. Okay, sacred space. I want you just to think with me for a moment that you're alive in the year 5180 and you live in Corinth. Here's the question. You want to have an encounter with your God. You're spiritual, you're hungry. You have an issue, a deep problem in your life. You've not been able to fix it. So if you're a Jew, you want to encounter Yahweh, what do? Well, you pray, but if it's bad, you have to travel all the way to Jerusalem. And at the top of the mountain in Jerusalem is the temple. While this is being written, the temple is still there. It'll be destroyed by the Romans 20 years later in 70 AD. And you come and you just say, Yahweh, you bring gifts, you bring sacrifices, and you say, God, I need you. If you are Greek or Roman and you have a huge challenge, you're going to go to the ultimate Greek god, Zeus. Well, if you need Zeus, where are you going to go? You're going to travel all the way to the city of Olympus. Because when you get to Olympus, there is going to be a temple to the god Zeus. And it is awe-inspiring. And you would feel humble. You would step before him and say, Zeus, please act on our behalf. If you need Athena because your crops are failing, your business is failing, and she's someone who brings blessing because you're in a conflict, she's also a goddess of war, where do you go to find Athena? You have to go to Athens. The very city that's named after her. And it's one of the seven wonders of the world, the great temple to Athena. If you need Diana or Artemis, she's called both. You go to where Paul's writing from in Ephesus. See, this is the thinking, is that you found the God in the place, the geographic spot. And that was sacred. The temple to Yahweh is sacred. The temple to Zeus and Athena and Diana, they were all sacred. Now, Paul steals that term sacred, and he says this: if the people of Corinth need to find Jesus, where do they find him? They find him when the followers of Jesus gather together. The embodiment of Jesus, Jesus did not leave a temple. You don't go visit the relic of the cross. You don't go visit the place where he resurrected from the tomb. You don't go visit the place where he taught or the Lake Galilee or any of that. You are going to find Jesus when you find the followers of Jesus. These imperfect people who, not individually, but collectively, this is the embodiment of Jesus here on planet Earth. And our world desperately needs this. This is why we have to heed Paul's words and say, we're ready to grow up. We're ready to get along because people need to walk in this room and say, I think I found something that looks like Jesus. And it's just a whole bunch of people. Like, I went to high school with some of them and like they're weird. I know their problems. But when they come together, there's just something beautiful. This is where Jesus is. I want to show you a couple of pictures just to help us re-envision what sacred places look like. This is this room. Right? A little bit more full than it is today. But this room, when people fill it, we're singing a song, it's sacred. I love it. I usually sit right there and I'm just like, I love this. Guess what? I'll be in here tomorrow. I always come in on Monday, come into this room. It's completely dark. I don't even know where the light switches are. and it'll be cold, and it's a little bit spooky without you here. It's only sacred when you're here. Next picture. Church at home, everybody's watching online. This is sacred. This is a family gathered together. Next picture. 55 plus, dinner they have. I'm 5 years and 2 months from being eligible to attend. But look how happy you get when you go. This is sacred. This is sacred. Small group. This is where you're going to find Jesus. Sunday night, last week, a week ago, my living room, which is just a living room, became a sacred space when 8 of our friends came over and we did our small group together. You find Jesus there. How about at the end of camp, the last day, when you just had a color war, and all the freshman boys haven't taken a shower in 5 days. It's sacred. This is God's field right here. The last picture. How about preteens? They're crazy. But you put them in a room with some couches, that's God's field right there. That's sacred space.
We hope that this helps you take your next step on your spiritual journey. If you'd like to get involved with the work and ministry of Faith Chapel, visit faithchapel.cc and click on Next Steps. If you'd like to speak to a pastor or connect with us in any way, email connect@faithchapel.cc. We look forward to connecting with you soon.